session number 9893, reel 2.
Brigadier Montague Champion Jones, reel 2. How had you anticipated the outbreak of war?
Well, we knew in our manoeuvres in those days, from the time of Munich onwards, we knew how desperately short the army was, because all our manoeuvres, we had a couple of lorries and not more than 20 or 30 chaps, and everything was make-believe and pretense, that sort of thing. And when we got to the staff college, the thing that appalled us most of all was the realization that we had absolutely no defense against armor. And I think there was in Great Britain one anti-tank mine. This was all we saw that one was shown it, and so on and so forth.
Had you received mobilisation papers at all at any point before August
39? No. We'd been given our mobilisation stations before we went on leave in August, and then. But as to whether there was going to be a war or not, I don't think most of the army really believed that Chamberlain said it would be peace in our time. You know, I don't think we really thought that, because we knew something about the enormous armaments that Germans had built up. And then, of course, the staff corps, we studied that very much.
Had you any anticipation of what sort of war it would be?
Yes, I think we had, really. Anyway, by the time we went abroad, we knew pretty well, because Hitler's blitzkrieg methods had been pretty well demonstrated. And we also knew we had very little in order to shoot at them with. And, of course, the methods which were afterwards adopted in the desert and that sort of thing, of forming boxes and staying put and letting the tanks go around and stopping the infantry, hadn't really penetrated or been evolved. And so when we had our battle, we were told to hold the line of a road, a long, thin red line, and of course the German tanks just ran round it. But we come to that later, really.
Tell me about what happened when you embarked.
Well, we arrived in Portsmouth. And we embarked on these two destroyers, which were lying alongside at HMS Vernon. And it was a hot afternoon. We were kept down in the wardroom. At least the officers were in the wardroom. I suppose there were a good many other ranks in the other ranks' messes. And this, because the whole British advance party were on these two destroyers, and we were kept downstairs, so that the brass hats among us wouldn't be seen by possible spies ashore. And we were kept there a long time because we had one Blenheim aircraft, the first of the single-wing bombers that the army had, which was acting as our eyes. And it was supposed to report it. It had seen a shadow in the sea outside, and they thought it might be a submarine waiting for us. So we stayed put for an awful long time, getting hotter and hotter. And at last, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we moved out and were allowed up on deck once we got outside. We went off at full speed, which was rather fun if you'd never been on a destroyer at full speed before, lots of foam. And with the sun setting behind the Isle of Wight, and lovely sunny evening, it was really great, great fun. And halfway across, we suddenly stopped all this nonsense and reduced speed to a very slow crawl, because we heard they'd run a bearing in one of the turbines. I happened to know the ship's first officer, who I'd met during bridging camp at White Regis the year before. He said, "I've only had these." This lot about 3 days. How can I make an organized ship out of this lot? Look at their cap badges and their cap names, the ship's name. Every sailor had a different name on his cap. And Anyway, we eventually got to, at this time we didn't know where we were going, but we eventually landed in Cherbourg, and we were allotted, who were staying there, to land the BF, were allotted the best bedrooms in the hotel and that sort of thing. And the other destroyer never appeared till very much later, and we then learnt that it had got a steel wire cable round its propeller when it was due to leave Portsmouth, and it had to get divers with oxyacetylene cutting plant to cut it free before they got away. And they arrived about 7 o'clock, and it was slightly amusing for us because most of the people on that ship were intended to go on to other places by train, to Rennes and places like that. And there were more brass hats in that party than there were on mine. And we very junior people had the best bedrooms, and unfortunately brass hat had to spend the night in Cherbourg and only had the floor to sleep on.
What about the actual passage? Were there any incidents at all? Mm? What about the actual passage, the crossing?
The crossing was dead calm and beautiful. It really was very lovely, with the setting sun setting in the west, as the suns do. And there was nothing, apart from this slowing down halfway across, nothing much happened.
How were you received in Cherbourg?
We didn't notice anything, I don't think. We were given a liaison officer, a French liaison officer, to help things for us. And we had about 3 or 4 days to wait before the first contingents of the British Expeditionary Force arrived, during which we had to try and get ourselves organised. We knew that six ships would come in with about 1,000 troops on each, would come in to Cherbourg in the morning about 5:30, and that we had to get these people off, but we didn't know who was coming on them till the night before. And we had a large sheet of table given to us showing what was coming on these six ships, so we didn't know who was going to be in which ship. And there's great complications because we had to send an officer on each ship. Now the thing would have been to let everybody get off the ships so that they could go back, which is what the captains of the ships wanted to do. But our station commander wasn't prepared to have large bodies of troops standing about exposed to any air raid that might come along. So he said we've got to get them all organised on the ship. Well, the night before, we got this big schedule, and the question was, every officer who went, each one of the six officers who went onto these ships had to sort things, had to have a copy of this paper. And we had no typewriter, nothing whatever at which to copy it. So all we had to do was to collect the chaps who were going to go on the night before, and I had to dictate them. They had to draw out their own forms, and I had to dictate to them from this form, so that each one had one. That took nearly the whole night. Half past five, the ships came, we went on board, and we had to collect the give out on the blur that individuals travelling alone, draft conducting officers, etc., would assemble with their embarkation papers in the lounge, which happened all right. And we then gave them their orders. Meanwhile, the captains of the ship were champing at the bit, saying they wanted to get away out of danger and get back to England. And the first day was a bit chaotic, because the first thing that happened was half the ships were on the Quai de Normandy, which is where the car ferries arrive now, and they had to go round the head and get to the main station. And they had baggage. The manual of movements had said that the troops would carry their own baggage, but most of them came with a lot more baggage than they could carry, so we hastily had to get some French lorries. I suppose a French liaison officer ordered that, I don't know. Anyway, they came along, but by the time we'd got the baggage and stuff onto these lorries. It was lunchtime, so it was bon appetit, monsieur, and off they went for déjeuner. Well, the result of all that was that the they had to be allotted places in the main station where they could dump their baggage, and if they wished to go off in the town, which was perhaps a mistake. However, they all disappeared in the town, and they all came back in time for their train, so there's no harm in that. The first contingents were the most extraordinary experience I've ever known, because the support of an army like that arriving, one had no idea what it consisted of. It consisted of small units who'd only met their officer perhaps 3 or 4 days before. There's one particular one, which I think was a butchery section, had one officer, and he got a party of, I suppose, 40 or 50 men, I don't know, and he had no NCOs, nobody had had any training, and he had to select a sergeant major, a company sergeant major, and three other section leaders just by their looks. Anyway, this particular chap was not quite typical of the example, but I happened to meet him the rest of the day several times, and he kept coming to me and said, where do my troops get their train? And I said, it's not my business, it's RTO's business, but you happen to be a platform there, you see. But when I met him again an hour or two later, he still didn't know where he was going, poor chap. Finally, I met him soaking wet with water. He'd got himself underneath one of these things that fill engines with water. Heavens knows how. That was the last I saw of him. And he was very concerned at first, because we'd allotted each unit or group a space marked out with a letter marker in this huge station, where they could leave their baggage and shelter and that sort of thing. And he'd said, turned his back on them to talk to the RTO or something, and he said, put your luggage down. When he turned around, they'd all gone. And there was another unit that came along with a sort of unlit bonfire. I don't know, I think this was a bakery section or something, that they had huge great logs, about four-foot log, long, with which to make a fire, if they wanted. I don't know what sort of conditions were envisaged by the people who planned that. I suppose if you'd gone into the field and not landed in a big station in Cherbourg, it might have been some use. But and that was the typical examples of the very many subunits that came out first, and eventually when the regular battalions began arriving, of course, we breathed a sigh of relief. We're delighted at the discipline and the fact they can march off properly and get themselves organised.
What was the mood of these early arrivals?
Oh, full of beans. Very ready to get at Hitler, they thought. They thought they were going to have a wonderful time. And in fact, there was one chap who didn't belong to anybody, who just turned up. He'd got on a train up in the north of England. He'd got himself there, and he came off and said, "Now, where's Hitler?" And we had to send him back, which is very much against the grain, because that's the sort of chap you want, really. I don't know why. I don't remember what he belonged to. I think he was a pioneer or something. I don't know.
And where did you disperse these people to?
Oh, they were going down to meet up with their transport, who went round to Saint-Nazaire, and most of them were going to the roundabout Rennes, various places where they're going to be bivouacked and that sort of thing, to form the sort of backup for the main army, and then they would have moved up as the regular battalions and gunners and so on arrived.
Did you keep your quarters in the hotel in Cherbourg?
Yes, yes. In fact, there was, in those days, there was a casino there, and we made that into an officer's mess for officers passing through, and we produced pink champagne and oysters for them, Marin oysters, which relieved the monotony a bit, because it was pretty monotonous. It was pretty grim getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and, as I say, the first day, the trains were we'd planned to, thought we'd get people across in a couple of hours, and the trains would go away at 11 to 12, that sort of thing. The first train didn't get off till 4 o'clock in the evening. That got organised very quickly after that, all these things. They all arrived on time. This wonderful French centralised control with a big chart somewhere in Paris, which lit up in lights or something, that followed the movement of every train throughout France. It really did themselves proud. They all got from there on time. They got to the places they meant to, and so on. There was one unfortunate incident when we couldn't really get baggage wagons, organised the way the movement said they could, so that the luggage that got off at the first station was placed so it would come off first, then the next station, the next would come off. We couldn't, because of the nature of the trains and the baggage wagons, we couldn't get that done like that. And on one occasion when the general headquarters was coming through us, a lot of their baggage were put into baggage wagons in the front of the train, and there were others down the back. And we hoped we'd get the lorries carrying it to the back wagon, but it couldn't. They couldn't get there for some reason, I don't know, along the platform or something. And so it decided we should tell the train to move up and stop. So they put the baggage in the back, you see. But somebody said to me, once you get a French train moving off this, nothing will stop it. And we horrified to watch from the bridge this train sailing out with our grand GHQ's baggage left on the station, on the platform.
What caused the delays then, if it wasn't the arrival of the trains?
Oh, getting the troops organised and getting these disorganised parties into the right positions, the right places. They all found their right trains in the end. And that was the sort of chaos of a first day when we were hopelessly inexperienced, and we hadn't, well, none of us were experienced, of course, in this. And the books of the words, there's a movement manual of some sort, which we just hadn't envisaged this. The whole of this organisation was organised. As a great friend of mine, was he's dead now, as Sapper, who'd very proud of all this. And we said, we want more men later on. He said, well, I can't. I haven't got any train chaps, you see. He said, we don't need train chaps. We just need chaps to guide people about the place and get them to where they're to go, that sort of thing. Which I think he didn't take that very kindly, poor chap. because all these people, with our personnel and our movement control unit, were checkers, wagon checkers, who could write in chalk where the wagon was going to in the right way on the wagon, book it up, and we can see that it got off to its right destination and to its right place on the train. Well, we didn't have any of that sort of thing. We just had men to move about on their 2 feet. And, however, we got it sorted out.
What about the French people? Did you work with them?
Oh, yes. Well, we had a liaison officer who asked us a very nice supper one night. And apart from that, we didn't really have a lot to do with it. We had another officer from the North Western Railway, who was my opposite number on the railway side of our organisation, and he used to confer every day with the French railway station master and organise the size of the train and everything that was wanted for the people to come. One of the troubles was, you know, I said we had to dictate these forms. We eventually acquired a typewriter, but then the thing was to find a typist. And our sole clue to getting a typist, which we hadn't got, was we found somebody who played the piano, so we thought he might be able to learn and put him on. Our commander was deputy quartermaster general, a major who had been in all of the Northumberland Fusiliers, who had been out in Alton training horses for 12 years. And he was a very able chap, and he did a lot of things. One of the things was he collected bully beef and biscuits and things off all the troops and got some boilers down on the near the station, and we managed to give everybody a hot meal that was coming through. You see, there was administrative difficulties there, because the finance people said it's peacetime accounting. If the troops have been issued with 3 days' rations, they don't get any more food till the 3 days are up. And they got rather tired of bully beef and biscuits, you see. So we managed to do that. Later on, we got our major went, illegally deserted the BEF and went back across to Southampton, went up to the War Office, who were astonished to hear that we didn't get all the troops didn't get fresh vegetables as soon as they arrived in this luxurious country, vegetable-producing part of France. And that's how armies work.
At what sort of intervals did the ships carrying the troops arrive?
Every day. Six ships, 1,000 troops on each, at 5:30 in the morning. And we had to get them away as quickly as we could.
Were you in any danger at that point in Cherbourg?
Well, we thought we were. We weren't. We tried to dig some trenches, but we didn't know what was going on. This was part of the trouble. I mean, it'd be so easy to get everybody straight off the ships and then sorting them out. But you didn't want crowds of soldiers standing about in concentrated parties, and an airplane with a machine gun might come over, you see. And we tried to, before they arrived, we tried to dig some trenches, but we found that the quay sides, which were sandy, were, the moment you dug, they were huge, great boulders. They were filled with huge, great granite boulders from somewhere, which you couldn't dig a trench in those. We did make some narrow little shallow slits, which I suppose if we'd been bombed and people had been lying down, it's a few might have escaped, I don't know. But as all was peaceful, nothing ever happened. Old Hitler missed a chance there. He wasn't paying attention at all. He'd busy elsewhere. And we were really very lucky, because it would have been very nasty.
What about the baggage? Did the troops still arrive with all their baggage?
Yes, well, they had to handle their own baggage. There was much... The ordinary infantry hadn't got more than they could carry, that was true. But all sorts of people, like nursing sisters, for example, we had at one stage we got some hospitals came through with quite a large number of nursing sisters of the Queen Alexandra's military nursing service. And every one of those had an officer's uniform case, which is quite big for a young lady to carry. And all those had to be got onto lorries and taken round and somehow humped up across to the appropriate platforms and things like that, for which we were not equipped at all.
And did you aim to get the hospitals and the other things out as quickly as the troops as well?
They went in their turn just the same. You see, everybody arrived one day, went off by the evening of that day, somewhere. They didn't stop, but they were all separated from their transport, which went round to Saint-Nazaire for some reason. Well, I suppose that was a better place to land transport. There wasn't room for large quantities of army transport at Cherbourg.
How long did this continue for?
After the main battalions, the various corps and formations arrived, it went on at a steady and an even pace for more or less till Christmas. In fact, it's still an embarkation port when I left.
Did the pattern continue of the ships arriving every day?
I think so, pretty well, yes. I got home on leave once and came back on one of the ships. We were able to get things organised a bit before we arrived.
Did any of these ships have any problems getting across the channel?
None at all. They all thought they were going to have. They were terrified of being torpedoed or something. And, well, that really is all I have to say about that period, which takes us up to Christmas. And it settled down into an evening show and nobody was worried about it. And
when the ships had disembarked their troops, did they go straight back?
Yes, they went straight back to Southampton or wherever they came from.
So they were travelling back in daylight?
Oh, yes. They were all these cross-channel steamers, which were the holiday transport of the previous summers. That's all the ships that went across from wherever it is to Belfast and that sort of thing. Across the Irish Sea, across the Channel, everywhere the ships went, they'd all been brought down to do this.
What was your own lifestyle like during these 2 or 3 months that you were there?
Very boring, really. We found Cherbourg a very depressing place. It was, it had sort of cliffs around the behind it, and we did get out on 1 or 2 days. Our major and 2 or 3 of us went out in his army transport to look at the country round about. But apart from that, we were very confined there with nowhere to go and not much to do, and well, not much time to do anything pleasant. We did 1 or 2 people coming through. We one of the officers, one of our railway chap, knew a senior ATS woman who came out, who had lots of stories about the First World War, and we managed to take her out to supper at a place in the town. Otherwise, there wasn't very much to do, and we were really too busy. So something was happening all day long.
And what was France itself like and the French people?
They were just French people. I mean, we didn't have much to do with them except the liaison officer and the people who worked for us. They called the first lot of troops the armed rebel, which is, you know, before the regular troops came, because they were, it did appear so chaotic, but still, in spite of difficulties and a certain amount of muddle, which was fairly soon sorted out, really, they all got to their destinations, got to the right places and so on, except the unfortunate chap who came looking for Hitler and had him sent back.
You mentioned that you had leave. How long a leave did you get?
I think it was about a week. I was due to go for another leave later on, when it was cancelled because the Blitzkrieg started. Hitler started coming into Holland.